Thank you for listening to Classical U's podcast, for following us with our courses, training teachers, parents, school leaders on classicalu.com. On the podcast, we interview guests that are recording with us, leaders and authors that we're in conversation with related to how to run a great classroom, how to deliver the liberal arts, great books, classical languages to your students. We also have a webinar series, live learning events, that is in collaboration with Scholae Academy and Scholae Communities. Encourage you to watch for those as well. Those are monthly, and we're delighted to have you. Thank you. Junius, it's great to have you here again at Classical Academic Press and recording with Classical U, three different courses. Again, you're one of our record-setting presenters, being able to lay down just lecture after lecture. And it is exciting where I'm delighted the three very different topics that you're recording on this week. Some material with Augustine for us and on the topic of teaching music and finally teaching medieval history as you're working with CAP on the Humanitas volumes for our high school history curriculum and specifically the medieval period and talking about some of your own insights into teaching that content, which is content that really isn't, I don't think, understood or appreciated, you know, very well at all in kind of typical high school teaching lineup. So cool territory to be stepping into with you and always fun to have you here. We're going to start out with one of two podcasts that we're hoping to record together and share with everybody, talking about the topic of teaching music. I would be interested to hear how you would kind of summarize the standard understanding, because I know you have a little bit of your own take on this, but the standard understanding of the place of music within the quadrivium, you know, the quantitative arts. And, you know, how does it relate to the others, and what's the kind of the typical understanding of that?
Yeah, so the quadrivium, it's funny, if you look at certain authors, and Hugh of St. Victor comes to mind, he will use the term mathematics to describe the quadrivium. And that's actually, I think, why mathematics is plural. There are four mathematical arts, and those are arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Well, so what that means is all of these four arts, what they're about is number. Number in different sorts of ways, right? Abstract number versus embodied number, right? So arithmetic is abstract number and geometry is embodied number. Or continuous music, continuous number versus discrete number or whatnot. Music kind of has this role where it's related to arithmetic. So they're kind of paired off, where geometry and astronomy are paired together and music and arithmetic are paired together. And so
does that fit with the continuous, discontinuous?
In some presentations, it does.
Okay.
Hugh of St. Victor does it slightly differently, but sometimes they do try to do that to where arithmetic and music are discrete and geometry and astronomy are continuous.
Okay.
There are a couple of different ways of doing this, as I've said, but I think what they probably have in common is this notion that in arithmetic, you're dealing with number in some sort of abstraction, mm-hmm. whereas in music, you're dealing with number embodied. The sound is a physical thing, and you know, you can visually see the embodiment of number on the string as you quarter the string and half the string to make the different ratios.
Yeah. You know, there is some connection, as you and I have chatted about this just over lunches and stuff, with some aspects of that kind of traditional relationship, and then but your own particular beef that you have with it, if that's not too strong a term. But so describe your own take, and you've written about this, and would love to get this shared with the world in some form eventually. But do you talk about it in the course as well?
I try to focus in the course on the way it's been done historically. I do gesture towards the fact that I have a there's a course correction I think we need to make in this. But even with that, it's the course correction I would suggest would not be to replace this original, this traditional understanding, but rather to add to it.
Okay.
And that's simply that I'm not convinced that if there's one object of the quadrivial arts, I'm not convinced that it's number. And I'm also not convinced that there is one object of the quadrivial arts. As a musician, the way of talking about music through number doesn't feel like it has anything at all to do with what I do as a musician or why I as a human engage the musical arts. I think there's something else going on in music that number is a way of describing, but that isn't fundamentally what music is about. And so I, even though I'm not talking about that in this course, the goal of this course, where the point is to restore music to the humanities classroom. We can talk about that some more in a minute. But so even though I'm not talking about that in a philosophical sense, nevertheless, I'm teaching out of that sort of understanding of music as a much more, as much more to do with the spiritual side of human life than with the numerical mathematical side. And I understand for Pythagoras, those two were one thing. And I think we have to remember the quadrivium owes a lot to Pythagoras's mysticism, or at least the Pythagorean's mysticism. But that's not the way that I would go about getting to the transcendent qualities of music.
So just in a nutshell, because I do want to get back to the course content and the place of music, you know, as one of the humanities and its relationship within the liberal arts traditionally. But what would be in a kind of, you know, thesis, one sentence format, your distinctive approach?
Yeah. So I, as I mentioned a moment ago, there are two assumptions made about the quadrivium as we classically have it, that they have the same object and that object is number. Mm-hmm. And so all four of the arts are talking about number, but in their distinctive modes. Mm-hmm. I would challenge both of those theses. I don't think that there is one object of the quadrivial arts, and therefore number is not the one object of the quadrivial arts. However, I think their objects, whatever they are related to one another in such a way that they can all be meaningfully and profitably talked about by means of the objects of the other arts.
Okay.
So that would mean that it's not wrong to talk about music from the standpoint of number, but that is almost a transferred discourse or a metaphorical discourse, because the proper discourse would talk about music in terms of its own proper object, which I'm calling, for lack of a better term, the oreme. This is from oral, as in something you hear with your ear, and then that eme ending, as when a morpheme or a phoneme, the smallest unit that carries that the meaning of the thing, right? Mm-hmm. The morpheme is the smallest unit of meaning. Mm-hmm. The phoneme is the smallest unit of sound. The oreme is the smallest unit of intelligible musical content. It's probably, I think of it, something like a musical note, but I'm not 100% willing to say that, because there are gradations within the note as we talk about tuning it, sharp or flat or whatever. You know, our A in America that the orchestra tunes to is not the same A that orchestras tune to in Europe, for example. Mm-hmm. And those are orally distinct. And so really the note A is a representation of a range of oremes.
Okay.
And we see one of them in use in America and one of them in use in Europe, right?
Yeah.
But those things, out of that oreme, you build up the individual notes, you build up the scales, the harmonies, and ultimately melodies and entire pieces of music. And so if that's true, if all of the quadrivial arts can be described profitably from the standpoint of the object of any of the quadrivial arts, then what we've done so far in the quadrivium in the West is we've looked at the whole thing through number. That's one quarter of the project. But then we need to look at the whole thing again through shape, whatever the object of geometry is, and again through the oreme, and then again through whatever the proper object of astronomy turns out to be. Right.
So the oreme would actually relate to the other quadrivial arts in your...
That's right. Yeah. So we could think about arithmetic through the oreme. We could think about geometry through the oreme. Okay. And then one of the instincts or even maybe intuitions that's already there in the tradition is to think about astronomy through the oreme. That maybe the music of the spheres is not primarily a mathematical reality, but is primarily a musical reality in the way that we understand the term music these days.
Okay. So you're by that move from number to oreme in the case of music, or you know, potentially even the other three quadrivial arts, you're moving a step away from the abstract to the tangible, because the oreme does sound... That's a bad sounds. I was going to say the sentence. It sounds like a reference to sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very concrete, a physical experience.
Yeah.
Am I understanding it correctly?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. But it's almost like, think of it like geometry, right? If the proper object of geometry is shape, which can be numerically represented, but you know, we reduce the Pythagorean reduction of it to number.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's the other big commitment I'm working with here, is saying that all is number, I get how that's exciting to a mathematician, mm-hmm. but to me that feels reductive. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm losing important aspects of things, right? And I think a mathematician would want to show me how, no, it's because your understanding of math is too small. You think it's a reduction. Yeah. And I'd be really patient of hearing that. I think I would learn a lot from that conversation. But at the end of the day, I feel as if there's just more to my encounter with reality. I don't want to reduce reality to mathematics any more than I want to reduce it to music, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So let's say that the object of geometry is shape. That is, you might say that's more determinate, more particular than number, mm-hmm. Insofar as it's now this, you know, visualizable thing. And yet, it's not any particular shape. Mm-hmm. And even when you talk about circles, it's not any particular circle. It's the principles that underlie circles, a figure with all points equidistant from the center, right? I think the same thing is in true of music. It's not any particularly played musical note. Right, it's the fundamental quanta building blocks out of which musical notes are made, from which we then get all the rest of Western music.
Mm-hmm. So, the jumping back to the what we've lost in our understanding of music I think most people would have some relationship and experience with talking about music as one of the fine arts, but. We don't talk a lot, you know, in our contemporary educational settings and, you know, lives about music as a quadrivial art. So what do we gain by talking about music within, you know, the humanities or within the liberal arts? What have we lost by, you know, not having that and just thinking of it in terms of, you know, fine arts or, you know, performative, creative arts?
Yeah. So I'll get at that with a story. I was at a conference last year, and they were doing a panel on music. And they had some musicians up there performing a piece of music, and then three very well-known talking heads in the classical education movement discussed what was going on there, one of whom was a musician by training, the other two were not. So they did that, and then the musicians played a second piece, and then they talked about that. All of these three individuals on stage were brilliant minds at the top of their game, doing wonderful work in thinking through classical education, what that means today, the classical renewal movement, all these sorts of things. But the two who were not musicians, there was a very noticeable and sometimes explicit self-consciousness about talking about music. Mm-hmm. They were asking permission. Is it okay that I have an opinion about this? Is it okay that I think this? Right. That's a really strong illustration of what we've lost. It feels like music is the province of the professional musician, whether that's the performer or the musicologist, and that all the rest of us are too ignorant of it to really talk about it, and we'd best just keep our mouths shut. And even if we are otherwise used to speaking about the liberal arts, we can't talk about music. What does it mean when somebody who's an expert in the seven liberal arts feels like they don't have permission to talk about music? Mm-hmm. It means that music is no longer a liberal art, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It means that we don't have a vision for a place for that discipline in the liberal arts. So that's what's lost, and that's a quick look at what's lost. But then, how did that trickle down? Whatever work it is that music does in liberating the human soul, we're not doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Or we're not able to talk about it.
We're not able to talk about it. Yeah, if it's happening, we're not able to thematize it.
Outside of very specific sort of technical or performative context.
And music as a fine art, and so music as my fellow musicians do it and talk about it, music as musicologists talk about it, and music historians and whatnot when I hang out with that crowd, has nothing to do with the liberal arts. Mm-hmm. That fine arts music doesn't do the work that music as a liberal arts does. It's a different type of thing. It's all about performance. It's all about the everything that is attendant upon the performance and the presentation of the music. But the performance of the music, which I'm deeply, deeply, you know, attentive to and concerned about as a performing musician, the point of performing the music is to broker an encounter between the listener and the music, mm-hmm. not the performance itself, right? The mm-hmm. performance itself is the means to something greater. Mm-hmm. It should be, to use Augustine's distinction, it should be used, not enjoyed, mm-hmm. right? But we don't have a category for that anymore. We don't have ways of thinking about that. So I used to teach a course. This course that I've recorded for Classical U is a version of a course that I used to teach at Baylor. Mm-hmm. And I would bring in some of my musician friends to the class. And so I brought in the bassoon professor who had been with me at the School of Music at Yale. I brought in a harpist, a professional harpist, who was a really good friend of mine. And I brought in several other horn players, and we played a famous horn section solo mm-hmm. from a piece for the students.
And your own instrument is?
The French horn.
Yeah, yeah.
And so these guys are coming into my classroom as experts in musical performance, and they're giving performance for the students, which the students love. They get to see the instruments up close. They get to really hear something, right? It's very, very cool. But all of them, when they came out of the classroom and were talking, walking away from that class, they were like, that's an unbelievable class. I'd love to take something like this. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never been able to think about music in this way before. Mm-hmm. These are conservatory-trained professional musicians with orchestra jobs. Mm-hmm. And they look at my classroom. One of them was I brought in a conductor, and he's conducted the LA Phil. Mm-hmm. And he was like, your classroom, that's where it's at. That's what's going on. It's not because I was doing anything so incredibly, you know, innovative or whatnot. It's because we were talking about music as a part of the humanities, as a liberal art rather than as a fine art. And even the experts in the fine arts were attracted to that, and they immediately saw that's missing in my life, and that would really deepen my encounter with music if I had mm-hmm. that.
That's amazing. The part of the difference then, as I'm thinking about it just in the moment here, is the performer's technical requirements versus the audience's human requirements. Mm. Is that fair?
That's a great way to put it.
So the fine arts, you know, approach is serving the performer's technical requirements. What we've lost in the classroom and in everyday life is the understanding that music as one of the humanities or liberal arts in the quadrivium is serving really the ultimate end for even the performers of the receptive, transformational, you know, engagement of an audience.
That's right. And because of that, because we don't have that in our education, and, you know, meaning education in the broad sense of institutio, in the building up of the character and disposition of the human person, mm-hmm. which happens both in the school and in the church and in the home, because it's lacking from every single one of those places, mm-hmm. you find that the fine art of music is becoming increasingly niche mm-hmm. and increasingly irrelevant to people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so every orchestra in the country is struggling to sell their subscriptions to their season. Mm-hmm. Top orchestras like New York and LA are struggling to sell their subscriptions because, and they keep thinking, what do we have to do to connect to the people? What can we do to connect to the people?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like saying, you know, gosh, we're sitting down here near the delta of a river, and it's 90% polluted with all of this junk. What do we need to be doing to get this pollution out of the river? From that location on the river, there's not much you can do.
Yeah, you gotta go upstream.
You gotta go upstream.
Yeah.
And so the orchestras, I don't care how many gimmick concerts they try to put on and how much teaching they try to do at the community for the orchestra level, there's nothing corresponding to what they're doing in the souls of people anymore, right? Or rather, that's not entirely fair, it's atrophied. And we're looking to satisfy it in different places, right?
Yeah.
Because we do, music is still a huge part of our lives.
Yeah.
Right? We love, Taylor Swift is massive.
Yeah.
Right? She's building so much influence that some people have come up with a conspiracy theory that her connection to one team in the Super Bowl is an attempt to get Biden reelected. I mean, that's how much power a musician can have in our culture,
yeah.
right? So we still love our music. You can't take that away from us.
Yeah.
But we've divorced that from intentional character formation. A side effect of that is now music is doing unintentional character formation. Mm-hmm. Right? We listen to these songs, and we listen to all these songs about people who are breaking up or people who've been hurt in love or whatnot, and we subtly try to make our lives conform to those songs. Mm-hmm. Right? We reach for those songs when we're in those situations as expressing how we are, but we also subtly sabotage ourselves to bring ourselves into conformity with that music, because that music is shaping, these are the things that it's worth feeling.
Yeah.
These are the ways that it's worth living, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a destructive influence that music is having on our lives, that popular music is having on our lives. And part of that is because we're no longer paying attention to it. We're not self-consciously doing it. And the lack of intentionality, we lose control over whether those habits being formed are vicious or virtuous.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that that's not entirely about the type of music itself, but it's about the ways in which we're consuming it? Mm-hmm. So when you have, there were literary societies, you know, all across the United States in the early centuries, you know, of our nation, and people carried, you know, copies of Shakespeare in, you know, the covered wagons when they could only choose, you know, just a few items of survival, and, you know, your literal life and survival was on the line. You know, Milton and Shakespeare typically made the cut somehow.
Yeah.
And then they would, you know, when you had four households close enough together to call it, you know, a settlement or whatever, they had a literary society almost as fast as they had a school or church. And that idea of sort of gathering to talk about and engage with, you know, the humanities and the liberal arts, it seems to me that we're consuming popular music in some realm that doesn't involve any kind of contemplative practices together, you know, any conversation about it. And then the classroom is the most natural place for that. So like the story of the classroom that you told, you know, in your Baylor days, what's happening there is you're giving the listeners, you know, those who are appreciating the music, a chance to engage directly with the performers, but to talk about music as transformative of, you know, our souls, and to talk about music in terms of what it's like to listen to it, not just the technical aspects of performing it. And that's the conversation that seems to have evaporated.
Yeah,
that's gone.
Right.
And there's no spaces left where it happens, because the only side that we bring to the classroom tends to be reaching for, you know, the technical, the performative.
Yeah. Well, in my youth, myself and folks older than me, anyone who grew up before the digital age of music, right? We would, when a new album came out, right, somebody would go and buy the tape or the record or whatever time we're talking about here. And then you'd go to your friend's house, and a couple of friends would gather together, and you'd listen to it together, right? And that first experience, and you talked about it together. And it was a regular thing that you would do if you were going to spend time with your friends. One of the things that you would spend time doing would be listening to music together.
Yeah.
And that's something that we don't do anymore, right? And that was one of the things that the classroom provided, was not only have they all listened to the same classical music, but now in the classroom, I'm playing it for them. And they're listening. We're all listening together. And then I'm stopping. So, okay, let's talk about what we just heard in that section, you know? And then there's a conversation that gets going that runs throughout the entire piece.
Yeah. Right?
And I modeled that in this course. As you go through the course, there are three demonstrations. And in each demonstration, you're asked to listen to the piece ahead of time. And then as I go through, I talk about what's happening in various moments in the piece, and then I stop and let you listen. And there's no beautiful artwork for you to look at while it's happening, because you don't multitask music, right? The thing you're supposed to be doing is listening, and that requires all of your attention. That's how we ennoble things in the world, is we give them our attention, right? But that's also how you read closely, is by giving things your attention.
Yeah. So the course, you know, that you've just recorded for Classical U is restoring the art of listening, giving attention to music, and then talking about it together, not in terms of how to perform it, but how to hear it and how to experience it.
And what it means.
And what it means.
How do we put this back into the conversation of the great conversation of Western culture? My model for this was Germany. In Germany, they don't have humanities.
Yep.
They have what's called Germanistik, German studies. And when you major in German studies, you're studying German literature, German philosophy, German theology, German art, German music, German drama. Right? All of cultural production together is studied as one discipline. And the idea is, you know, what is the object of German studies? The object of German studies is not Goethe or something like that. The object of German studies is the German soul. It's Germanness. right? Mm-hmm. And I loved that image of the integration of all the humanities into one path to understanding something greater than any single one of them, right? And so I was wanting to restore that way of engaging with music. It's no accident that Germany has such a rich musical heritage, given that that's how it's been approached culturally, mm-hmm. and in many ways is still approached, at least in some quarters of the culture mm-hmm. today, right?
So that idea of the German soul mm-hmm. that you're just referencing is very similar to the great epics, Homer and then how that's picked up in the Roman soul with mm-hmm. the Iliad. I mean, there does seem to be this in the classical tradition, this attention to the soul or the heart, the life of that's shared among a people, and the imitation even of a culture that's inspired, so the Roman imitation of Greek culture, and that seems to be very similar. And then in the classical world, as Americans, we should be looking to the great epics of the English language, as kind of a common shared ground and heritage, Chaucer, Milton, Shakespeare, and then musically, So am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the one thing I would say is that we are, America's a melting pot, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Our language is English, but our culture comes from all over the place, mm-hmm. and our people come from all over the place. And by the time we get to the England that people have in mind as being our past, by the time you get to someone like Chaucer, mm-hmm. You have cultural identity as being formed in such a way that it doesn't exclude earlier cultures, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, whoever came before the Greeks are not part of Greek culture. But the Romans are the first culture in this line where the people who came before them are part of their culture because they stole Greece's culture, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. They were like, our culture's not going so well. We'll just take yours and change all the names.
Yeah, it was hardly subtle.
Yeah, exactly, right. We'll just change the names to protect the innocent, right? And from that moment forward in Western culture, the formation of culture has included situating yourself within the stories that go all the way back to the Greek culture, mm-hmm, to Hesiod mm-hmm. and Homer, right? And so it's not just the English epics, it's not just the English music, mm-hmm. it's all of the Western epics, mm-hmm. it's all of Western music that are part of where we're trying to find ourselves as Americans here in the mm-hmm. 21st century, the first quarter of the 21st century.
So that obviously with the German example, you mm-hmm. can't help but ask, how does it go awry? Mm-hmm. There's a nationalism, a fascism, mm-hmm. that can be a sort of distortion, twisting of that can sometimes, I think, be somewhat subtle, mm-hmm. But obviously it goes very obviously wrong. Mm-hmm. What's the danger there if we start, in classical educational, renewal and work that we do as educators, saying, we're looking for the soul of, of our people? Mm-hmm. Because I love the idea, but what are some of the dangers?
It's great. Yeah, I think the real danger is that we make the mistake of thinking that the soul that we discover by this process of intellectual archaeology, cultural archaeology, is kind of a basic fact, and therefore is can be taken to be good, right? There's no, you don't have to judge it in any way. It's just who you are, and it's okay to be who you are. And so because what you're going to discover is that there's a lot of stuff in that soul that's gross. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff in it that's base. There are grooves worn in that soul that are habits of vice rather than of virtue. Mm-hmm. And so one of my favorite writers, Hans von Balthasar, his dissertation was called The Apocalypse of the German Soul. Mm, mm. By apocalypse, he means that in the etymological sense of the revelation of mm-hmm. the German soul. And so Germanistik was his subject matter. And so what he was trying to do with this massive project was to lay bare just who the Germans are.
Okay, yeah.
That's the first step in the process. It's not the last step. Hitler gets to that point and he thinks, look at how great we are. This is who we are. And mm-hmm. part of that greatness is not just the nobility of a Siegfried, mm-hmm. but it's also the viciousness of a Siegfried, the mm-hmm. the unstoppable power of the Volsungs mm-hmm. to whom Siegfried belongs. And so all parts of the Ring cycle are to be imitated. and not just the noble parts, mm-hmm. right? If it's in the German soul, then we act out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The next step is supposed to be self-reflection,
mm-hmm.
even judgment,
mm-hmm.
right? What's the apocalypse in the Bible all about? It's about judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just mm-hmm. the revelation of God, but God is revealed as the judge of nations, right? And so if we don't take that next step to say, okay, so this is, we've now uncovered the American soul. This is who we are.
Mm-hmm.
What of that should we be proud of, and what of that should we be ashamed of?
Yeah.
Right. If we're going to obey what Aslan says to Prince Caspian,
yeah.
Actually King Caspian at that point, that you have the blood of Adam in your veins, you're a son of Adam, and that's glory enough to raise the head of the lowest beggar and shame enough to lower the head of the mm-hmm. mightiest emperor. If we're going to take that seriously, then we have to look at where are the shame parts and how do we go to work on mm-hmm. rehabilitating those? That's what the classical tradition is all about, right? We don't take everything human as good because it's human. But we do take it as necessary to understanding what's human and as necessary, fallen human,
mm-hmm.
and as necessary to an accurate diagnosis and
yeah.
treatment plan for how we're going to go forward from there.
That's helpful. Yeah. So in a fallen world, when we reveal things, revelation always carries, or apocalypse, you know, an aspect of both displaying the glory of God,
mm-hmm.
the image of God,
mm-hmm.
and judgment. Like you just reveal it and it's obviously evil,
yeah.
and you've just condemned it by revealing it,
yeah.
you know, so yeah, that's great. Then, you know, it's a process of continual revelation, and we're constantly seeking to reveal what we have in common,
that's right.
to judge and to, you know, give God glory.
And especially since we are always a work in process,
mm-hmm.
right? We're looking at the past because it's a, you know, tradition is not something that passively falls on us, is something we have to actively receive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of active passivity. I think that's what we lose from having Latin rather than Greek be the main dominant language, is that the controlling language of our classical studies is that what Latin lost, the middle voice.
Yeah.
Right? That it's not just you're active or you're passive, but there's this middle ground
yeah.
where you are active, but you're also receptive. And maybe the activity is to clear space for receiving that which would come to you, right?
Yeah.
So because that's the case, that's what tradition is. We're receiving these things, we're taking them up,
mm-hmm.
right? We reach out to take from the past and bring it to ourselves, and then it changes
mm-hmm.
as we change, and we're changed by it, and that's the point. And
mm-hmm.
then as we hand it on, what we hand on is different than what we receive because it's got the mark of us on it now as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in Dante's Paradiso, the light of God shines down through all of the spheres of the planets,
mm-hmm.
and it changes. Each of the spheres puts their own stamp on it,
mm-hmm.
and all of that influence gets communicated downward to the lower levels.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So with your course, do you recommend engaging different, you know, types of music, popular, classical, as listeners, you know, as where do you go with some of the distinctions?
Yeah, with the course, no, because generally speaking, multitasking is not good for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't lead to excellence.
Back to the attention point.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. I can't teach all things at all the time. I would have fun teaching a, you know, classic rock version of this course as well. But for the purposes of thinking about how are we going to deploy this in our schools,
yeah.
I'm doing Western classical music. And there's a real reason for that too. And I talk about this in the course. One of the things that I'll teach a lot of literature courses on books that are not considered canonical.
Yeah.
This fall I taught a course called Fantastic Literature.
Yeah.
And we had canonical books in there, things like T.H. White's The Sword and the Stone from The Once and Future King.
Yeah.
But we also had contemporary works of fiction like Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising
mm-hmm.
or Diane Duane's So You Want to Be a Wizard.
Yeah.
You know, these are some of these books that I teach. I would not recommend you put on your school's reading list for,
yeah.
right? There's a reason why. So on the one hand, why do I teach them? Well, I teach them because I'm confident that I can teach close reading from anything. I can teach close reading from the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, I want to teach close reading from books that reward close reading.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, I want to teach close reading on books that are going to get the students excited so that they can't wait to get the reading done and they can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because close reading is a form of loving, and it's easier to learn to do it on something that you love.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that said, I wouldn't put Harry Potter on your school's reading list
mm-hmm.
for any grade level.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Is it because I think that Harry Potter is not serious literature and that you can't have a serious conversation about the things that matter to human life from Harry Potter? 100% no.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely do that.
Yeah.
But Harry Potter is not in conversation with the great tradition self-consciously in the way that Paradise Lost is,
mm-hmm.
in the way that even The Hobbit is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're choosing, but the fact that we don't allow certain books into our classroom is not necessarily an elitist, highbrow claim that they're mm-hmm. not worth spending your time on and you should feel guilty if you read them and don't tell anyone, right? That's yours. That's your secret thing. You can do what you want with your spare time. The reason is because they're not well suited for, they don't form the same type of entry in the great conversation
okay.
as other books do. Now, yeah. obviously, Harry Potter is in deep conversation with the tradition. Its understanding of heroism, its understanding of good and evil, all of these things are in conversation with the Iliad forward.
Yeah.
But in a very non-self-conscious way.
Yeah.
In a way in which I'm not sure I could sit down with J.K. Rowling and have a meaningful conversation about some of those things in the way that you and I can.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Maybe I can, maybe I can't. The evidence is not there in Harry Potter that I could.
Yeah.
Right. So, same thing in music. Anyone who thinks that music, that classical music is better than popular music or something like that, I've got two pieces of advice for you, or one piece of advice and one example. The piece of advice is just go listen to an entire Led Zeppelin album from start
mm-hmm.
to finish. Listen to Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to a Queen album. You're going to see that this is, if you really give it your attention,
mm-hmm.
this is not only really good music, it's also the kind of music that you could teach a course on. You could talk about everything that really matters in life from this course.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to just do one of those things, pick up Pink Floyd's The Wall
mm-hmm.
and then come back and tell me that you don't think that that is in conversation with all of Western literature.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The second thing is this. This is an issue that musicians struggle with all the time because, and this is a fine arts type of problem, right? In the fine arts, because we're the fine arts and we're so fine, we have to prove that we're not the non-fine arts,
mm-hmm.
right? The crude arts or whatever you want to call them. So we have to separate ourselves from lowbrow art.
Mm-hmm.
So all of my musician friends, you know, they speak very dismissively of Andrew Lloyd Webber
mm-hmm.
in the same way that my artist friends speak dismissively of Thomas Kincaid.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I've been able to tell, there's no reason for this other than snobbery. There just isn't. You should not make people feel bad about liking Thomas Kincaid or liking Andrew Lloyd Webber because there's stuff to like there. There's some really fantastic musical writing in some of Lloyd Webber's musicals. Phantom of the Opera is a key example of this. Some of the best Broadway horn writing I've ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so what we do is we try to figure out, okay, so where's the line, right? What's good, what's in, and what's out? And essentially what you want is you want the way you can really lay this out is opera is undeniably in
mm-hmm.
and musicals are undeniably out.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can figure out what the difference is between a musical and an opera, then we can use that to delineate
mm-hmm.
what, you know, separates highbrow art from lowbrow art. So I spend a lot of time on this and I spend a lot of time in conversation with my musical colleagues about this. And I'm here to tell you that there is no criterion you can offer that will successfully distinguish opera from musicals. And even if you don't know a lot of opera, and even if you don't know a lot of musicals, I can prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Any criteria you choose is gonna break on two data points. West Side Story, which was written by Leonard Bernstein, one of the greatest conductors of all time and one of the greatest musicians of the 20th century, a great composer, a great classical composer of the 20th century, West Side Story is considered a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Porgy and Bess, written by Gershwin, a jazz musician who's got
mm-hmm.
classical chops, right? Some Gershwin stuff makes it in the classical canon.
Yeah.
But it's sung, you know, the whole way about how it's produced and everything
mm-hmm.
and all this other kind of thing. That's considered an opera. It should be. Both of those two things should be reversed.
Mm-hmm.
Every criterion I've ever heard proposed for how to separate these things crashes on those two
mm-hmm.
things. And the reality is someone who would look down on West Side Story because it's a musical
mm-hmm.
is missing out on a powerful piece of Western music
mm-hmm.
that is deeply in conversation with everything that's come before.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true of someone who would look down on Porgy and Bess. And I would argue the same is true of someone who would look down on Les Miserables or Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to say they're all equally good. That's not the point, right? Paradise Lost and Pilgrim's Progress aren't equally good, but they're both on the list of things we should be engaging. So yeah, so that's a long way to go about answering your question, but I don't want anyone to think that because this course is about classical music, which is the type of music that I mostly perform. I do also perform jazz and a little bit of rock, but mostly I'm a classically trained musician. I don't want anyone to think that because the course is about that, there's some sort of implicit claim that other forms of music are bad.
Mm-hmm.
There is bad music. And I'm going to call out, you know, if asked you, I would call out bad pop music and bad church music. But the problem is not that it's pop music. The problem is not that it's church music. The problem is that it's bad music. And I would also call out bad classical music as well. Not all classical music is good just because it happens to be written in the classical style.
Yep. So we're running short on time, but I'd love to fit in hearing how you came to fall in love with music yourself. So what's your own story as, because you know we've made the distinction in the conversation between performers and fine art technical skill and then listeners or audience, but obviously every performer and is also their soul is engaging as a listener even as they perform. And I've heard your story a little bit, and I think that comes out. But how, what's the arc of your own journey into classical music and love?
So when I was a child, my brother, I have a brother who's 5 years older than me, and when you get to fourth grade, you can join the band. And so he came home with this sheet that had the list of all the different instruments that you could choose to play, and you had to check off which one you wanted to do, and your parents had to sign it. And so he wanted to play the saxophone, so he checked that off, and my parents signed it. And then they showed it to me, and they said, which one do you want to play when it's your turn? And I didn't know what most of them were. So he's in fourth grade, right? So I'm in kindergarten. I didn't know what most of them were. Saxophone sounded cool, like just the name sounded cool. But I knew that I couldn't choose that because my brother had chosen that. And that was kind of the rule, is that we couldn't do the same things. That was our rule, not my parents' rule. And so I was kind of at a loss. And I was like, what's that instrument that they always play in the movies whenever a king comes into the room? And my parents were like, that's a trumpet. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to play the trumpet, right? Everyone stops and pays attention. Yep. Something important is going on and the trumpet's playing, right? So when I got to fourth grade, I talked about it all the way until fourth grade. I was so excited. So my parents went ahead and bought a trumpet because it would be cheaper than renting one. I'm so into this, right? I get it. I start taking band, and they teach you how to play it. I come home, and I'm like trying to play it, and I was just like, I hate this. I want to quit, right? I was like, Dad, I'm going to quit the trumpet. He's like, no, you're not. I bought it. You're going to play it. So I was forced to stay in, and quickly got better. Elementary school band was whatever, but I learned the fundamentals of playing the instrument. Mm-hmm. When I got to sixth grade, most people were starting in sixth grade in the band. Mm-hmm. It was a really good band program. And so the two trumpet players, myself and this other guy who had trumpet at elementary school, we were ahead. And so we were automatically first chair, right? And it was like, whoa, nice. I got a head start on this thing. From that moment on, it was a meritocracy. It was about being better than the person next to you. And that's actually what drove me out of the path of conservatory music, was I got tired of the constant competition, the constant measuring yourself against other people, and the constant attacks. If you were worse than somebody else, they threw it in your face all the time to keep you down. And if you were better than somebody else, they chipped away at you all the time, trying to break you psychologically so they could get a jump and get ahead of you, right? I did not love music. I loved playing the trumpet well, and I loved being better than other people.
It was a competitive
thing. It was, and I hated being worse than other people. When I got to high school, we had a fierce rivalry in the trumpet section among three of us. I could name names, and if I named names, I would name first and last name, and that's how you know it's a big deal, because the people in your past that you name by first and last name, those are the ones that something's up with them, right? And they were great guys. I mean, it's not I didn't see that until later because we couldn't through the rivalry. So anyway, I eventually got jumped ship and started playing horn, and I loved playing the horn. I loved the sound of it. I loved the feel of playing it, right? The energy of playing. It's a full body experience, and playing it well is so exciting and so good. I still didn't really love music. Right? So now I'm in, by the time I graduated high school, let's say, I didn't love music. I loved playing my instrument well, and I loved hearing other people play my instrument well. A good sign of this is I hated Mozart. Mozart was so boring for the horn. It was like not that much to do. A couple horn, the horn concertos, yeah, those are great. But like a Mozart symphony, oh my gosh, I'd rather play anything else. And there was a time in college when I was sitting in the practice room working on something, and I was just overwhelmed with this feeling of delight and joy in the thing, and it wasn't about playing the horn well. It was about the music itself. And I went back and I put some music on. I started listening to it, and it was like I was hearing it for the first time. And I put some Mozart on. I put on a Mozart symphony, and I was like, this is kind of incredible. So I was a performing musician from fourth grade to maybe sophomore year of college.
Wow.
And did not love music in the way that I'm hoping people coming out of this course will.
Yeah.
It was something, it was a way to apply this skill that I was developing and that I loved doing, but I didn't love the thing itself. And this happens. People come out of conservatories hating Mozart. Right? Oh, it's so whatever. I have to play some 20th century music where they're pushing the boundaries of musical expression and whatnot. And I was, that kind of boredom with classical music indicates a serious disordering of your loves. Right. I don't know how many times I have heard Beethoven's Third Symphony. I don't know how many times I've played Beethoven's Third Symphony. And when I hear that it's going to be performed, I get excited. Right. Someone says, you know, I was recently given, I was told about a new set of recordings of Beethoven symphonies, a new conductor that I had never heard before, and I couldn't wait to go listen to them, and I listened to them, and they're amazing. Jos van Immerseel and Annemarie Terna, they're all on YouTube. Check them out. Jos is spelled J-O-O-S, and it's, oh my gosh, it's so good, right? I've heard these symphonies dozens of times. I've played them all multiple times. But, you know, in the same way, I've read the Divine Comedy 8 or 9 times. I'm not tired of Dante, right? You don't get over these things. They become part of you. They become favorite friends. Our favorite pop songs, the songs that really speak to our pain when we're hurting or that express our joy when we're happy, you never get tired of hearing those songs, right? So I think that's illustrative of the way that being a performing musician is not necessarily conducive, and often the way the training goes is detrimental to being a lover of music. And for me, it was locked in a practice room, forced to give attention, something about, you know, my level of maturity at that point in time and the attention that that situation required me to give to it, that it all kind of came together at once. And like a gift that I wouldn't know how to repeat for myself, the door was opened.
I was going to ask if you had any, you know, theories or suspicions as to, you know, how it came together for you.
So much was going on in my heart at that point. You know, it was such a formative time in my life in terms of relationships and my faith and my studies. And I think there was just all of that worked to create a susceptibility in me. I had been planning to quit. Actually, you know what? I remember it was my senior year. It wasn't even my sophomore year. I had been planning to quit playing horn at the end of college. I was basically doing it for scholarship money. And so I was going to quit and give my horn away, and I knew who I was going to give it to. And after that day in the practice room, I was like, I will never stop playing this instrument as long as I'm able.
Wow. Wow, that's beautiful.
And all of my most, all the musical accomplishments that I'm most proud of came after that moment.
Well, good. Thank you, Junius. This has been a delightful conversation, and I look forward to our next podcast, and it's wonderful working with you again.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Classical U's podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We release podcast episodes once a month with our presenters. Please also check out our live learning events, webinars, in collaboration with Skole Academy and Skole Communities.